Hi, this is Bernie Wides, the Naturalist, back on the air of the Heritage Radio Network, being broadcast from Roberta's terrific restaurant in downtown Bushwick. And our sponsor today is Salumi Artisanal Cured Meats, in which I'm sure they make a whole line of Italian-style deli meats and other delicious products. So today we're going to talk about a few things that have to do with some of it very local, some of it on Long Island, and some of it I know it's next week is vacation week for New York City kids and maybe in the suburbs too. So I'll talk about some things that you can do and a topic that you may even be able to check on yourselves, even though it's still winter time. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is this neighborhood of Bushwick. I'm going to talk about Newtown Creek. Now, Newtown Creek is not very far away from us here, and it sort of marks the border between Queens and Brooklyn. And Newtown Creek is part of the system around the boroughs of New York. You know, all of our boroughs are really islands, except the borough of the Bronx. The Bronx is on the mainland. Manhattan is an island. Staten Island is an island. And Brooklyn, Queens, and Long Island are one big island. So in the western end of Long Island is Brooklyn and Queens. So they're really on islands also. So we have this terrific network of waterways around New York City. But because of many years of industrialization and the dumping sewerage in the waterways, we have a tough time cleaning them up. But we're making progress. And since the city has built water treatment plants to treat the sewage, the waters have been getting better, and the wildlife that live in the estuaries are getting better. We have seals now that are back in New York Harbor, harbor seals, and some other seals that come here for the winter, and you may even be able to get to see them. But I'm going to talk about Newtown Creek today. Newtown Creek, which forms part of the border between Brooklyn and Queens, as I said, is one of the nation's most polluted waterways. It's filled with toxins from a century and a half of industrial activity. It is the site of a huge underground oil spill that's been causing problems in Greenpoint, Brooklyn for decades. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has proposed making Newtown a national priority for cleanup by putting the creek on its so-called Superfund list. The federal government, about probably 20 years ago or maybe 30 years, set up a list of the worst polluted bodies of water in the country. And Newtown Creek is going to be put on it. Now, what does this mean? Well, we'll talk about this right now. Well, a woman named Kate Zida, an environmental partner, a planner, with the Newtown Creek Alliance, is looking out on a tributary of Newtown Creek called the Maspeth Creek in Queens. Here's a picture here that I didn't put on the gallery because it's not a really great photo. But this woman, Kate, is looking out on a little branch of Newtown Creek, and she says it's not a pretty picture. The bulkheads are crumbling. You know, with the bulkheads are the walls that hold up the shore of the creek. The bulkheads are crumbling. There's a car upended. There's, you know, kind of mysterious things afloat. In the harbor, which Newtown Creek's supposed to flow into, if you put something in there, those waterways are flushed regularly because, you know, our estuary is tidal. So the tide comes in every 6 hours. It goes out every 6 hours. And the tide does a fairly good job of flushing a lot of junk out of the harbors and waterways. But Newtown Creek is a dead end. It's a little creek where it can't be flushed. In Newtown Creek, especially up here where she's talking about, stuff stays put and it gets into the sediments and it compounds this issue of historic pollution here. So things settle down in the sediments, which is the collection of stuff at the bottom of the creek. And a lot of the sediments, as she says, are highly polluted. That long-standing pollution is what's at the center of the Superfund proposal, which is in the middle of a public comment period that's been which they had in December. So I haven't been able to find out what the results of that conference was. If Newtown makes the national priorities list, the EPA would start with extensive sampling of the sediment. Walter Mudgen, director of the Superfund Division for New York Region, says the agency already did sampling earlier this year and found contamination in just about every part of the creek. We found some kinds of metals, copper and zinc in particular, contaminants that are associated with, for example, manufactured gas plant sites, but also with asphalt plants and other kinds of operations. We found PCBs, Mugden said, and you know this thing about PCBs and the Hudson River, which I'll talk about in a minute. Five of the big companies who acknowledged their role in the pollution, ExxonMobil, BP Amoco, Chevron Texaco, Phelps Dodge, and National Grid, have approached the EPA with offers to pay for the sampling that would follow a Superfund designation. After that, Mugden says, officials would decide whether to dredge the contaminated sediments. And then the question is, how much of it do you dredge? And what do you do after you've dredged? Choices are, you dredge a little bit and then cover that over with clean material, or you dig much more deeply and try to get out the contamination out as far as and as deep as it goes, he said. So that's really a big quandary, what to do. And what are you going to do with the sediments? The sediments are loaded with all of these chemicals. They've been on the creek bottom for decades, and probably to this day, the creek is probably being polluted further by these companies that are situated along it. Now, in this report, it said the companies offered to pay for the sampling if it's put on the Superfund site. But this article didn't say anything about the companies chipping in to pay for remediation, which means to clean it up. And you know, you probably know what's happened in the Hudson River with General Electric, which is way up the Hudson. And for years, they had a manufacturing plant that made transformers. And the transformers were filled with PCBs as a coolant because the substance PCBs are very stable and they don't break down. And they're a very good insulator for transformers. So they were used for years. And General Electric in their manufacturing process dumped water from their plants into the Hudson River that were laced with PCBs. And those contaminants are in the river. And they finally were forced by the feds and the state after the delaying tactics of 20 years where they had these delaying tactics, refusing to do it and saying, well, we're going to take you to court, and they postponed it for 20 years. They're finally starting to do it. And the question is now, those sediments that they're dredging out, some of the sediments are traveling down the river as they take them out. You know, they use these big clamshell scoops to get them out, but some of it drops back in the river. So that's a real problem. So we'll stay tuned to find out what happens with Newtown Creek. I'll try to get an update and a further broadcast. And if you get a chance one of these days and it's a nice day, take a walk over there and look in the water, and you'll see how terrible it really looks. So I'm going to sign off in this segment and leave you with the polluted Newtown Creek. And when I come back, I'll talk some more about pollution and about some hopeful signs. So this is Bernie Wise, the naturalist. And remember, our sponsor today is Salumi Artisanal Cured Meats. Hi, this is Bernie Wides, a naturalist, back on air, Heritage Radio Network, and our sponsor today is Salumi Artisanal Cured Meats, and I'm sure they make a whole line of delicious Italian-style deli and cured and smoked meats. So the first part of the show, I spoke about Newtown Creek, which is in really terrible shape, and there's another place in Brooklyn called Gowanus, the Gowanus Canal, which was highly polluted, and people had formed an alliance, just like they are doing out here in Newtown, to get it cleaned up. And the advantage that the Gowanus Canal has to over Newtown Creek is, many years ago, the city put a propeller in under the water, a huge propeller, to make circulation in the creek. And it has helped a little bit because fish are back in the creek. I wouldn't eat them, but I know people have told me they've caught young bluefish in the Gowanus. And people are canoeing on it and cleaning up the waterway. And maybe eventually they'll get it remediated and cleaned up. So hopefully there's good news on the Gowanus, and maybe in a few years we'll have good news about Newtown Creek. So I'm going to talk about our environment and something that is happening that is really a hopeful sign. We're going out to Long Island, to Greenport, which is way out on the North Fork of Long Island, and I'm going to talk about the scallop industry. Okay, so I got this title of this article says, Long Island harvest may signal a comeback for scallops. And it says, this is from Greenport. It says, bone-tired but grinning, Peter Wenzel and his son Ben eased their 26 workboat toward the dock one recent afternoon. This was in the fall. It's decked piled high with bags of scallops. Well, if you don't know what scallops are, they're the shellfish similar to oysters, and they had that beautiful scallop shell where, you know, the Shell Gasoline Company, the symbol for Shell Gasoline is a scallop shell. And years ago, the scallop shell was a symbol of fecundity or fertility, and it was used a lot in the medieval art. So this fella, Ben Winslow, called out to the dock, the people on dock, we got our limit, 22, So Ben called out, and he said, we caught our limit, referring to the state's daily limit of 10 bushels per person for commercial scallop fishing. You know, there's a limit even for commercial fishermen, how much they're allowed to catch, to try not to overfish. For the baymen of Long Island's eastern shore, out in force this month, in their orange waterproof jumpsuits and knee-high galoshes, the November opening of the scallop season has not always been so rewarding. So this is talking about what happened in November a couple of months ago. Beginning in 1985, multiple surges in toxic marine algae, known as brown tide, have decimated Peconic Bay's scallop population, resulting in years of dismal, economically devastating harvest. If you are a regular listener, you know I did a program on toxic plants, and that's what they're talking about now, toxic plankton or algae, which were affecting the scallop crop. But last year, the baymen realized that the scallops might finally be making a comeback. The yield was more than three times that of 2007. And this year's harvest is expected to be at least, if not better, scientists working in the area said. The recovery resulted partly from dedicated efforts by scientists to rebuild the scallop population. This professor at Long Island University was instrumental, and his name is Stephen Teitelbach. Dr. Teitelbach is in the fifth year of a five-year, 2.3 million bay scallop restoration project financed by Suffolk County that has released nearly 5 million scallops into Peconic Bay waters. Working with researchers from Cornell Cooperative Extension, a university outreach group, and the State University at Stony Brook, Dr. Teitelbach has helped create densely packed scallop sanctuaries, primarily in Orient Harbor, Halleck Bay, and Flanders Bay. If you looked on a map of Long Island, those are bays on the North Fork. The South Fork, you know, is where Montauk and the Hamptons are. The North Fork is Greenport and going out to the end of Orient Point. And there are a lot of beautiful bays there where the scallop industry used to be terrific, and they're trying to bring it back. Part of their strategy is to increase the rate of spawning and fertilization. Successful fertilization occurs when scallops are released into the water column close together, he said. In a separate effort, the Nature Conservancy in New York has released hundreds of thousands of baby scallops into the Peconic Bay since 2002. So you had all these groups, the Nature Conservancy, which is a great organization, Suffolk County and Cornell Extension, and and Stony Brook University and LIU all cooperated in this effort. Yet considerable mystery still surrounds the onset and waning of brown tides, said Christopher J. Gobler, a professor at Stony Brook who studies toxic algae. Scientists know that toxins in brown tide, which tint the water a coffee brown color, slow the rhythmic movement of scallop gills and prevent feeding. So there was all this stuff in the water to eat for the scallops, but one of these toxic algaes slowed down their rate of feeding because scallops feed by opening their shell up a little bit and using their gills to draw water in, and they strain out the plankton from the water column. So they're filter feeders, just like clams, oysters, mussels, and critters like that. Brown tide also blocks sunlight from reaching the bay's bottom, where eelgrass beds grow and scallops nest. More perplexing is why brown tide comes and goes. It generally blooms in stagnant estuaries that are not regularly flushed with fresh waters, and in those where nitrogen concentrations are high. So this is really a mystery, and you'll hear why. We know if a water body is more likely to get brown tide, Dr. Gobler said, but it can also break suddenly, and we have no idea why. In the late 1990s, nitrogen levels in Peconic Bay dropped to 0.2 milligrams from 0.4 milligrams per liter, and brown tide faded away. But scientists are not sure why the nitrogen decreased. You know, nitrogen is a fertilizer. So if you have a farm or a garden and you want to stimulate growth, you put down nitrogen and phosphates, and the plants take it up and use it to grow. Dr. Gobler hypothesized that the rise in nitrogen levels in 1980s was related to fertilizers used in potato farming that may have entered the groundwater and then run off into the bay. Many potato farms have since been replaced by vineyards, which use less fertilizer, he said. But after testing, he found that nitrogen levels in local groundwater had not changed in most places and had increased in some. Dr. Gobler is now involved in a new federally funded effort to determine why brown tide blooms occur when nitrogen levels are high. And, you know, the theory is that when the nitrogen levels are high, the phytoplankton grow more quickly because it's like fertilizer. For now, regardless of the science, the Long Island Baymen are simply happy to enjoy brown tide-free Peconic. On opening day of the scallop season, which ends in March, the Wetzels drove their catch to Southold Fish Market in a pickup. Euphoria reigned in the back room, where Baymen cheered one another as they raced to shuck the scallops. Because what they do after they catch the scallops, they shuck them. That means they take out the part of the scallop that's edible, which is the adductor muscle, which holds the shell closed. That's the only part that's really edible. The rest of it is too soft and mushy. Cries of knock 'em off were heard as they slid the butter-like meat into the buckets. Scientists predict that this year's Peconic Bay harvest will amount to tens of thousands of pounds, meager compared with the hundreds of thousands of pounds caught in the 70s and early 80s. But to a new generation of baymen like Ben Wenzel, for whom bountiful harvests are a marvel, hope is growing that scallop fishing will reemerge as a reliable source of fall and winter income for the fishermen. His first 10 bushels, about 80 pounds, sold for $12 a pound, bringing in nearly $1,000. And he said the cash will help to cover his rent that he shares, the apartment that he shares with his girlfriend. So that's good news that the scallop crop is back. And you know, scallops are really delicious. I think my daughter Erica did a show on shellfish, but she should do another one on scallops now that the crop is back and we have these delicious bay scallops. You know, there are two kinds of scallops, bay scallops and ocean scallops. The ocean scallops are much bigger, and the adductor muscle is, of course, bigger, and that's the part that we eat. But the bay scallops are much smaller, and I think they're a little bit more delicate than the ocean scallops. But when you prepare scallops in a meal, you have to be very careful with them, because don't overcook them. Just cook them very briefly or brush them with olive oil and put them in the oven under the flame for a very short time, and then they're delicious. So I'll talk to Erica, and maybe she'll do another show on the scallops, since that fishery seems to be coming back. And you know, there's an attempt on Long Island to bring back oysters also. I don't know if you've been listening that long, but one of the first shows that my daughter Erica did, I was her guest, and we spoke about oysters, because at that time, I had an oyster project in the Hudson River. We're trying to restore the oyster crop into the Hudson. It'll be a long time before we can eat those oysters because of all the contaminants in the Hudson, but to reestablish the oyster reefs in the Hudson are important because oysters filter the water and help to clean it up, like all shellfish do. And I remember when I was living on Long Island, and I was doing a project in this little beautiful harbor out east of Port Jefferson, Mount Sinai Harbor. I would see guys driving up with sacks of clams, hard clams. And I would say to them, "What are you doing?" And they'd said, "Well, we're planting these into Mount Sinai Harbor," which was a very clean, pristine harbor in those days. It's east of Port Jefferson, about 10 miles. And they were taking hard clams that were caught in the bay off Staten Island and the Raritan Bay and those areas, which you couldn't eat the clams from that area because the coliform bacteria count was too high because of inadequate sewage treatment. So they were taking the clams from New York City out to Mount Sinai Harbor and putting them in Mount Sinai Bay for 2 weeks. And then they would catch them again, and then they would bring them to market to sell. And, of course, they were inspected by the state. So if you ever want to buy clams or any shellfish, and you're driving around on a road in Long Island, and you see a truck at the side of the road selling shellfish, don't ever buy it, because you don't know where that guy caught them. Because every sack or a bushel of clams and other shellfish that are caught in our local bays and waters are sampled by the state or by the Suffolk County to see if they're safe to eat. So you can be pretty sure if you buy them from a reliable seafood store that they're safe to eat. Because, as I said, they're filter feeders and they take in a lot of bacteria. And if there's too much E. coli in the water, you can really get very sick. So there's good news for the scallop harvest out on Long Island and hopefully for some of the other shellfish industries. I know the oyster industry is thriving on Long Island in Oyster Bay. Believe it or not, the Bay of Oyster Bay is a prime shellfish habitat. And this company, the Flowers Company, is doing very well. They've been there for generations. And if you want to visit them, they'll be glad to show you around and give you a tour, because it's a very nice group of people, and I was out there last summer visiting, and they gave us a great tour. And they're pretty highly mechanized, and it's not a simple way that they grow them by just harvesting them from the bay bottom. They take the little baby oysters and put them out in the bay on huge, huge flats like rafts, and the bottom of the raft is covered with screening. And these are baby oysters that really thrive on that because they circulate water through them and they do very well. And then they'll take them and put them down in the bay bottom. And this company, the Flowers Company, has rented the entire bay from the town of Oyster Bay so nobody else can take oysters out of there. And then when it's time to harvest them, they don't have guys going out with rakes the old-fashioned way to do it. They use vacuums. Big vacuum cleaners, like a vacuum cleaner, but a big tube. They go around the bay bottom and suck up all the sediment from the bay bottom and hopefully the oysters. And then they clean them and sell them to fish markets, fish stores all over the country. And they're marked Pine Island oysters, and that's the kind that they have because many years ago there were oysters at Pine Island. So I'm going to end this segment reminding you that this is Bernie Wides, the Naturalist, and we spoke about some good news of the scallop industry out on Long Island, and that we have a lot of work to go yet to clean up all of our waters. So this is Bernie Wides, the Naturalist, signing off this segment of the show. And our sponsor today was Salumi Artisanal Cured Meats. And I'll be back shortly. Hi, this is Bernie Wise back on the air for our last segment in this show. And I spoke about some local stuff. And now I'm going to talk about something that kids can do on their vacation. Even though it's still winter outside, I'm going to talk about hibernation. Not that I want the kids to hibernate, but I want them to get outside and look around and see which animals are still out in the wintertime. Wait for a nice sunny day. Go in on your neighborhood if there's some greenery around, or go to one of our great city parks and see which animals don't hibernate. You know, you always see squirrels in the parks collecting acorns and to store, and everybody says they store them away for the winter. And they do that. But on a nice winter's day when there's no snow on the ground and the sun is shining, you see the squirrels out. They're still foraging for food. And we have many birds that live in the city in the winter. And it's a nice thing to go out in the wintertime and see which birds live all year round in New York City. And if you want, you can put up a bird feeder in your backyard. And you can feed the birds. You can get some birdseed mixes in some of the supermarkets and put them out and try to put it out where the squirrels can't get at it, because they'll eat it all up very quickly. And some of the birds that you can see that live here all winter, I'll just name them, and you can look them up yourself and look for pictures of them. The black-capped chickadee, which is a tiny little bird, is very, very active, and they flit around all winter. And you could train those chickadees to come to your hand. If you have a backyard feeder and you hold some bird seed in your hand, the chickadees will come up and eat right out of your hand. So that's one nice one. The blue jays we are all familiar with. They're beautiful blue and white, and they make a lot of noise. There's one called the white-breasted nuthatch, which looks something like a chickadee. It has a black cap with blue wings. And that the nuthatches climb up and down the trunks of the tree. Chickadees don't do that, but you'll know a nuthatch when you see a bird scrambling up the trunk of a tree. Another one is the downy woodpecker, which is a small woodpecker. And they're active all winter. And the Carolina wren, which is a tiny little bird, they are also active all winter. And you know the sparrows are here, and we have a lot of different kinds of sparrows in New York City. And the sparrows were, the English sparrow, so-called, was brought over from England because people wanted to have birds here that they were familiar with in England, so they brought over the sparrow. But there's another kind of sparrow called the fox sparrow, which is bigger, and you'll find on the ground a lot. It likes to pick up leaves and look for bugs and stuff. So on a nice warm winter's day, you'll see the fox sparrows out scouring around for food. And then there's another one, the goldfinch, which is a beautiful one. It looks like a little canary. And they're here in the winter, too. And you could watch them this time of the year when they slowly turn golden color. And they are a bird that's a finch. That means they have a very thick bill because they're a seed eater. So they will come to your feeder if you have a feeder. Or you can see them in the parks. They love to hang out in evergreen trees. And the cardinal, which is a beautiful bird. The male is all red color. It's called the cardinal because it's the color of the cardinal's outfit in the Catholic Church. And the female cardinal doesn't have that beautiful red color. But these are just some of the birds that you can see around the city in the wintertime. And it's great to get out in the winter, just dress warm. And if it's a sunny day, go to the parks and walk around and see how many of these birds you can spot. Besides the pigeons, of course, where we have plenty. And we also have a lot of starlings, which were also brought over from England by some fellow who wanted to have the birds that were mentioned in Shakespeare's plays. And one of them is the starling. But some of the animals you won't see because they hibernate in the wintertime. And hibernate means that they sort of sleep during the coldest part of the year. And you won't see them. But as I said, the squirrels are active. They'll hibernate for a while. If there's a snowstorm and they have trouble and they can't walk around, they'll stay in their nests and just eat the food that they've collected and stored up. But there are a lot of animals that you won't see in the wintertime because they can't regulate their body temperatures like mammals can. We're mammals and we can regulate our body temperatures, and so can squirrels and raccoons. So they can be active in the winter. Okay, so why hibernate? It takes a lot of energy to stay active and warm. Energy comes from food, which is often difficult to find in the winter. Some animals have adapted to survive the cold by going through a long period of dormancy. That means the inactivity. During this special time, their body functions like heart rate and breathing slow way down. By hibernating, they conserve energy and improve their chances for surviving until the warmer weather returns in the spring, along with more plentiful food. So mammals like us can be active in the winter, but some of them choose to slow down their body temperatures and hibernate. So mammals, as I said, are warm-blooded, and when mammals hibernate, their body temperature drops. Breathing and heartbeat slows down, and they don't need as much food as when they're active. Depending on the species, body fat put on in the late summer and early fall may be enough to carry them through the winter, or they may wake up periodically for a snack from food they've stored in their burrows. So animals like the groundhog, remember this big thing about Groundhog Day? Well, the groundhog is a hibernator, and supposedly he comes out and looks around on February 2nd, I think, is Groundhog Day, to see his shadow, and it could tell you whether there's six more weeks of winter or not. That's really folk myths, but people make a big deal out of it because it's a lot of fun. And I remember last year when Mayor Bloomberg went out to, I think it was the Staten Island Zoo, to check out the groundhog, and he put his finger there, and I think the groundhog bit him. So maybe that was a clue that he shouldn't do that again. But he's a politician, but who knows. But, you know, reptiles and amphibians are cold-blooded. Their body temperature goes up and down with the temperature of their surroundings. They will not survive out in the snow and ice. If you know where they hibernate, you'll know where to start looking for them in the spring. So some of the reptiles and amphibians are, like there's a salamander, the blue-spotted salamander. They will hibernate all winter. And a lot of insects, too. Insects can't be active during the deep freeze because they're cold-blooded also. Like I know butterflies can't fly if it's below 50 degrees. But some of them are active and some of them are not. As I said, insects can't be active during the deep freeze, but that doesn't mean that you won't see them. Depending on the species, they may spend the winter as eggs, larvae, and pupa, and occasionally as adults. So you may find egg cases in trees or on plants or bushes or on the sides of houses from critters like the praying mantis, which the female will lay her eggs in the fall, and the larva will remain inside the egg until the spring and then come out and pupate into an adult. So that's one example of a critter that does that. And you might say, how do the animals know when it's time to hibernate? And they don't really have a clock, but they, in reality, they do have a clock in their body that is sensitive to light. They have a circadian rhythm that tells them when to go to sleep at night and to wake up in the morning, and we have that same rhythm. Basically, we're diurnal critters that we are active during the day. But the question is, what if the bedtime for these animals is the fall and time to wake up is the spring? For animals that hibernate, Bedtime preparations are not like yours. The clock doesn't signal bedtime. Instead, shorter days and colder temperatures and less available food may work together to trigger hibernation. And what about storing food? Well, a lot of these critters who are going to hibernate will store food. Okay? So what the animals do, the hibernating animals will then rely on this stored food. What they do is they eat a lot in the fall, and they build up a lot of fat and reserves. And they'll use that fat energy when they're hibernating. Small mammals will wake up for a short time during hibernation and eat food from their stores in their underground burrows, in addition to using up body fat. That's a perfect example of the squirrels. Squirrels will go out and forage in the winter, but they have stored a supply up in their nests. And a lot of critters that live underground, like voles and moles and mice, they also store up food for the winter time. But they also have body fat. And the famous one, the bear, that we all know about, well, bears will go into hibernation and they'll eat in the fall and build up a lot of fat. And sometimes they can get through the whole winter without going out for a snack. For frogs and turtles, you know, they all disappear. Where do they go in the wintertime? Okay, if they're living in a pond, the mud at the bottom of the pond is a cozy winter spot. It's even above freezing, since if you get a layer of ice on the top of the water underneath it may not freeze. So some fish can survive that way. Or if the pond bottom is a good option, how about underground? Many mammals, plus snakes, toads, and salamanders, spend the winter underground in rocky crevices, burrows, or under logs and leaves in the forest floor. Bats go underground in caves. If they go far enough underground, animals can get below the frost line, below where the ground is frozen and the earth is still soft. Pile a blanket of snow on top for extra cover, and it's pretty cozy, tucked away in a cocoon. That's the way many insects provide their own blanket. So insects will hibernate, and mammals and snakes and lizards. And so some critters spend the winter as eggs, like the tent caterpillar eggs. Some will spend it as a larva, tucked away in a nice warm place, like the cocoon of the moth. Inside it is the larva, and when spring's coming along, they will pupate into an adult butterfly, adult moth, and come out. So there are a lot of strategies for staying alive in the wintertime. And another example is adult ladybugs, also known as ladybird beetles. They hibernated under the bark of a tree or in leaf litter near the tree's roots. Sometimes they're even found hibernating in clusters inside people's houses. Don't worry, they won't harm your home, and they will leave in the springtime. And one of the earliest critters that will come out in the spring is the woolly bear caterpillar, which is really the larval stage of a moth. The larva of the Isabella tiger moth spends the winter curled up in a sheltered place under a log or perhaps under some loose bark. In spring, they'll spin their cocoon and prepare to turn into adult moths. So even though it's wintertime, it's still interesting to be outside. And a nice day when it's above freezing, take a walk outside and see what you can find. And if it's snowed, go out with a magnifying glass and look for little black spots in the snow. They may be an insect called a snow flea, and you may be able to see them, but they're so tiny, take a magnifying glass with you. So this is Bernie Wides, the Naturalist, signing off the end of this program. And remember, our sponsor today was Salumi Artisanal Cured Meats, a new sponsor. And remember to tune into my daughter Erica's show, Why We Cook. She's back from her trips, and I'm sure she'll have some interesting shows. And this is the Heritage Radio Network, Bernie Wides, the Naturalist, saying goodbye.